Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. So I'll just admit it, I have no style. I pretty much wear jeans and sneakers every single day. So when I see someone who looks amazing, I think, how'd she do that? Where'd she get her sense of style? Well, I may not have to ask actual humans that question anymore, because in the age of algorithms, it's digital assistants like Amazon's Alexa that eye your outfits instead of your tasteful friends. But can taste, a fundamentally human, organic, even sometimes indescribable thing, be reduced to coded machine learning? This hour on Point, the machine wears Prada. You can join us on air or online anytime. How did you form your taste in clothes, in music, in movies? Who do you look for inspiration? Is it a friend, a celebrity, or maybe now is it a digital assistant or an app? And can something as human as taste be learned by a machine? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Well, joining me now from New York is Kyle Chayka. His story, Style is an Algorithm, appeared on the beauty and style website Racked. We've got a link to it at onpointradio.org. Kyle, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So now that the entire nation knows that I'm a human who has no style, help me out here. How much, how prevalent are these new sort of digital assistants or websites that use code and algorithms and machine learnings to help people form a better sense of taste?
I don't think they're super prevalent yet, but I do think this is kind of the way that the future is going. So the device that I tried out for my article was the Amazon Echo Look, which is this small little cylindrical camera that you can put on your shelf. And you can command it, like Alexa, to take a photo of you, to take this kind of remote selfie. And then after it takes the selfie, it can like analyze what you're wearing and then judge it to see whether it's stylish or
okay,
not.
Okay, hang on here for a second, because we actually have a little clip from a promotional video for the Echo Look device. And in it, Amazon is explaining, or someone for Amazon explaining, that exact thing, that onboard camera that takes pictures of you and helps you decide what to wear.
We've also created an easy way to get a second opinion. Introducing Style Check. It combines the best in machine learning with advice from fashion specialists. Just pick two outfits and Style Check will give you a recommendation based on current trends and what flatters you.
So, Kyle, I can't tell if I'm laughing because it seems ridiculous or if I'm just nervous about our future. Like when you tried it, when you tried the Echo Look, what did you wear and what result did it give you?
So I wore a bunch of outfits that I would normally wear. And I think similar to you, I often just wear jeans and sneakers and a collared shirt. But I tried a bunch of different combinations and different, you know, things that I thought were either stylish or intentionally not stylish at all. And it's, I know that it preferred an all black outfit to an all gray outfit. I put on this peach-colored T-shirt and peach-colored pants, which I would not normally wear, and it did not like that.
So it's discerning in terms of its preferences for monochrome. It has to be the right kind of monochrome. Okay.
Yeah, you can't just wear any monochrome. And it definitely likes when you roll up your sleeves, which I think is a correct judgment. And it liked when I popped my collar on my shirt.
Trying not to groan. Okay.
Yeah, but the problem with the device is that it doesn't really explain why it thinks these things are good or why they're particularly stylish in comparison to whatever outfit you're judging. So, you know, it can tell you that it prefers rolled up sleeves, but it can't tell you why it does that or, you know, if you should always roll up your sleeves or never roll up your sleeves or always pop your collar or add two popped collars.
Well,
I don't know.
And that gets us straight to the heart of the matter, right? I mean, as you write in your piece, that it gives you like a percentage that, what, black clothes scored 73% against gray clothes at 27%.
Yeah.
But if it's not going to explain why, I mean, what does it tell you? Does it just say you look better? Full stop?
Yeah, it says things like, you styled this better, or this color looks better. It's just very general, vague statements.
Do we know how Amazon is coming up with those conclusions? I mean, like, is it taking global averages, or is it like looking to, does it actually consult, as the ad says, with fashion experts? I mean, how, there's something goes into the algorithm, right, is what I'm asking. Do we know what that is?
Yeah. I mean, I think the problem with a lot of algorithms is that they're not transparent at all. So what Amazon says is that it's a combination of machine judging it through an algorithm, and then also humans who are looking at your photos and probably providing some kind of input. So when you do take the photo and you feed two photos of two outfits into the app that comes with it, you push the button and it takes maybe a minute or two. And I presume in that time, Amazon's servers or whatever analyze the photos, give a kind of loose machine percentage, and then sends them to a person to kind of check, and maybe they pick, you know, why one thing looks better.
So, Kyle, the reason why I'm really excited to talk with you about this is, as my nervous laughter reveals, I both, you know, I like how technology is improving our world, but I also kind of am sometimes concerned by it. And the closer we get to algorithms and machine learning helping us navigate through our days, we keep coming back to this question about how human can it be? And I think that question is brought into sharpest relief with taste, right? Like, just the discernment of what is good versus not good, to me, has always seemed to be one of those wonderful, purely human things that happens by virtue of our experience, our cultures, our who we know, who we don't know, and also just that sort of magical mix of DNA and neural connections in our head, which makes some people tastemakers and some people not. I mean, I might be over romanticizing this. I get it, but you ask this question in your piece, like, can machine learning replicate or achieve taste? I mean, what do you come away with as your answer?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the way that I define taste is just what you said. It's this kind of ultimate human thing that's an almost subconscious judgment of what we like or what we don't like, or what we find to be part of our identities or what we reject. And so I think that's a really good thing, right? It's something that creates our senses of self. So when machines try to approximate that, whether it's like Alexa judging your outfit, or Facebook telling you who you want to connect with, or, you know, Netflix producing movies to fit what it thinks you want, I think when those things guide your consumption of stuff and guide your taste, then you're losing some of that like ultimate human element of deciding for yourself, and you're kind of displacing your agency as a cultural consumer to a machine.
Yeah. So here's the thing, though. I mean, does it really matter who's making the decisions, right? Is it the coders and the business people at places like Amazon, or is it the sort of traditional tastemakers in New York, Milan, and Paris? And here's why I ask, because you reference this in your piece. The famous movie, Devil Wears Prada. This is the blue sweater scene. 2006. We have Meryl Streep playing Miranda Priestly, and she's commenting on Anne Hathaway's blue sweater and saying, like, pulling the curtain back and saying there's a lot of people who went into helping her make that choice.
That blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry, when in fact you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff.
So that's from The Devil Wears Prada. Now it makes me wonder, what difference does it make if the machine wears Prada? So let me introduce a new guest in this conversation. Simon Doonan joins us now from New York. He's a fashion writer and creative ambassador at large for the New York-based clothing store Barneys, and he's author of Eccentric Glamour, Creating an Insanely More Fabulous You. Simon Doonan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So, given what Meryl Streep so immortally said there, does it matter if it's a small group of people in some fashion houses who are driving clothing style, or a small group of coders in Silicon Valley?
I don't think it does. I mean, I should tell you first what I'm wearing, and then you'll be able to look at my – you'll be able to assess my answers based through the lens of my style. I'm wearing, like – silver sneakers from Yves Saint Laurent that are have stars all over them and a very 1972 David Bowie glam rock. And then I'm wearing this insane sweater with like 8 million colors on it. Kyle has been shielding his eyes from it. It's very loud.
Many kinds of stripes.
Basically, I'm a freak in that I never worry about what other people think, and I never have. But I have been in retail long enough to recognize that most people don't think that way. There's a small group of people that are focused on using style for self-expression, flamboyance, you know, liberation, creativity, you know, having been through the 60s, the 70s, punk rock, glam rock, blah, blah, blah. Style was about liberating yourself and expressing yourself. But that's not how everybody sees it. There's a large number of consumers that are quite anxious about their clothes. They want to appear attractive. They want to look competent. They want to look pulled together. Their main concern is getting it wrong, quote unquote, making a mistake. So anything which comes along which gives people some input about, you know, what their choices are. I respect it because I think I'm so far from that point of view where I would care what other people thought.
But have you stood in front of an Amazon look? I want to know. Have you like if you were wearing what you were wearing now? I would love to know what the algorithm would rate you, because I mean, I take your point. Like, some people see style, fashion in particular, as the most wonderful expression of their individuality. But what Kyle was saying earlier in terms of the look pumping out percentages, like that's the opposite. It's sort of it's style on a mass level, right for the masses. Can that be tasteful, though, is what I'm wondering, Simon.
I think absolutely. If anything, it's painfully tasteful. Like what happens now because of social media and because of these kinds of apparatus that you're describing, people are becoming more self-critical and more anxious about their clothing. And the idea, the words basics, essentials, those become almost too prominent.
Well, so, Simon, hang on here for just a second, because we have to take a quick break, as you can hear from our incredibly stylish music chosen by a human being. Simon Doonan is a fashion writer and ambassador at large for Barneys. We're also joined by Kyle Chayka. His story, Style is an Algorithm, appeared on Rack. We're talking about whether or not it matters that a machine might be telling you what's stylish to wear. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Ever listen to the news and wonder, is there anything good happening out there? I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And each week, Guy Raz and I take you and your kids on wild adventures to explore the most wow-worthy news stories on the planet. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what happens when style becomes an algorithm. And we're joined by Kyle Chayka. His story, Style is an Algorithm, appeared on the website Racked. We've got a link to it at onpointradio.org. We're also joined by Simon Doonan. He's fashion writer and creative ambassador at large for Barneys. And we've got a lot of comments on this, gentlemen. We have a listener here from Twitter who actually says, Nathan is telling us that nobody picks out new music for my personal taste better than Spotify. On the other hand, on Facebook, Greg Surik is telling us multiple choices never include my choices. And on our website, Patrick S. says, style is all about self-expression. If you're letting taste-making algorithms choose your clothes, music, and cultural experiences, you're missing out. Kyle, let me just turn back to you, because that links to something that Simon was telling us before the break. Simon doesn't actually see, and I hope I'm getting this right, Simon, he doesn't necessarily see sort of the mass production or algorithmic reproduction of style as a bad thing, that we could maybe make the masses more tasteful using machine learning.
Right. I mean, I think there's an ambivalence that I have in my essay, where there is this question of if listening to a machine is any different than taking your fashion choices from Vogue or any other magazine. They're both kind of dictated from a source that's not within you. But I do think, I mean, you can be tasteful, like you can fit in to whatever context you're in with the help of an algorithm or with the help of a service like Stitch Fix, which gives you these kind of minimally stylish clothes. But I do think that deeper question of taste is like, what are you trying to express about yourself through your choices, and how can you find an identity and find a way of being in the world through the music or fashion or books or film that you consume? And yeah. I think that it's when that's too passive, that can be a problem.
Simon, do you think that's a problem?
Well, I think the word taste is a problem. I kind of recoil from it. To me, it always seemed like an oppressive concept. Good taste, bad taste. It was just designed to make people feel horrid about themselves. And I think I've always been trying to liberate people from oppressive ideas about that. I think an algorithm can make people pull together, comfortable, less anxious about their clothes. You know, there's a high level of efficiency there. People have kids, they have lives, they have stuff they have to do. Not everybody is like me and you know, wanting to dress like a psychedelic toddler, you know. I think most people have other concerns in their lives. And so the word taste sort of muddies the waters a bit, because I think what most people are looking for is that feeling of, okay, I've got it together, especially men. You know, years ago, we did a survey at Barney's to find out the main preoccupations that were driving men's purchases, because it's always been a bit of an enigma. And the dominant thing was getting it right. They use that phrase over and over again. I need to get it right.
Yeah.
They felt that there was some terrible abyss they were going to fall into if they wore the wrong shirt with the wrong tie. And that's, I think, a function of this idea of good taste, bad taste, which is a very 1950s thing. But now you can compound that with the internet, where everything is thumbs up, thumbs down, rocked it, didn't rock it. Like this horrible critical peanut gallery that young people are subjected to.
That you can't escape from, exactly.
Yeah, the social media, that worries me much more than an algorithm. Like people self-criticizing, it's very masochistic. And I always encourage people to sort of not fall into that trap if possible.
But, you know, this becomes, there's the risk of it becoming this weird feedback loop. And Kyle, I was remembering a part of your story you wrote where you referenced that, for example, we're seeing a lot more Airbnb postings with kind of the same kind of furniture and the same interior design, simply because that's what people who are posting on Airbnb see in other, other offerings. And so there's this new Airbnb style that was generated entirely, through the website. And, you know, that is, I just come back to it's the quashing of individuality, whether or not it's tasteful, in exchange for this like sort of machine-generated average, which still brings my heart down a little bit.
Yeah, I think what happens is, no matter what kind of digital platform you're talking about, it might be Amazon, it might be Instagram, it might be Airbnb, there's a style that develops that is safe, or it's the most effective style to kind of exist on that platform. And maybe it gets the most likes, maybe it gets the most people to stay in your house, maybe it's the optimized song length on Spotify or something. But I think the risk of depending on these digital platforms too much for deciding what you consume is that you fall into that kind of safe average territory, where maybe it does take away some of your concern, like your concern that you're not fashionable or that you don't have TV to watch or something. But that comes at the loss of, I think, some individuality and definitely some surprise. Like, I think it becomes harder to challenge yourself
Well, I just wanted to jump in here. I'm sorry to cut you off there, Kyle, but we have lots of callers who want to join us. And so I want to get to them before I lose too much time here. So let's go to Rhonda, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Rhonda.
Hi there. Hi. I just want to say I hope this algorithm helps a lot of people because I look around and I think, you left the home looking like that. And I'm like, and what I'm talking about is like, you might be a size 10, but you can get a size 8 jean zipped when you would look really more flattering your figure in a 10. Things like that. It just drives me crazy. And, just that whole, aspect of class, you know, to see someone that really takes, time to put their best.
Oh, Rhonda, sounds
like they look.
Okay, it sounds like we lost you there for a second, but I'm gonna take it back from you. And I have to say, Rhonda, even though I have, you know, fully admitted that I basically wear jeans every day, at least my jeans fit. I can tell you that. But I appreciate folks with your perspective that want to show the world that they care, right? And bring a little bit of that self-care dignity out into the world when they leave their homes. So thank you so much for your call. But Simon, it sounds like Rhonda's singing your tune.
Actually, Rhonda is completely the opposite of everything I believe in. She sounds like a fabulous person, and she's probably very helpful to her friends because she really does seem to care, as you noted. But I'm always encouraged people, let's get out of this head where we're always criticizing other people and giving thumbs up, thumbs down. And it can be very helpful. I'm sure Rhonda is the best bestie to have because she will help you improve the way you look. And there's no downside there. I just sort of, sometimes I walk down the street and I luxuriate and celebrate the range of people. And if I see somebody who's a bit, a larger person who squeezed themselves into some fabulous cheeky outfit, I think great in a culture where everyone's criticizing everybody else so much and criticizing themselves. Good for you. A bit of self-love and empowerment, not worrying about what other people think. So that's, I guess I'm a bit of an anarchist.
Well, really. So isn't that the solution then to our all my algorithm angst, that we should just like stop caring what other people think and wear what we want? Because you were saying a little bit earlier, like you thought the algorithms were going to help people because, you know, they're so anxious about how people are going to judge them.
Yeah, they are. But, and I do think the algorithms, I always think the algorithm helps somebody, you know, a mom with three kids. She's also got a job, husband, obligate, you know, people take on a lot these days. Yeah. So just on a pure efficiency level, I think it's really great. And I would never decry it because I think there's a lot of people that lead very complicated lives. They're working extremely hard. And so anything that comes along and helps them pull themselves together and feel good about how they look, is that's a positive thing.
Well, let's go. I'm going to take another call here before I run out of time. Martin is calling from Gallatin, Tennessee. You're on the air, Martin.
Hey, hello. On a broader note, I would like to remark, I'm a furniture designer, and furniture and fashion is closely related. And in the retail environment, there are software that help retailers to plan out their color distribution, paint colors, carpet colors, and it is to some degree automated by software that anticipate and look at the mass of colors and the shade and the hues, and it makes a recommendation also based on the golden rule of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
So it is different from fashion, but it is a system of fashion, if you like it, which is an old expression from a Frenchman. Anyway, that's my comment.
Martin, thank you so much for your call. So, Kyle Chayka, what do you think?
Yeah, I think what we're observing is the ways that our aesthetics are becoming automated. Like there's the system that helps you decide what kind of furniture you're designing and what color it is, even that proportion rule. Similarly, you know, Alexa will evaluate you and tell you how effective your outfit is as a combination of clothing. And I think we're seeing that in all different aspects of life, no matter where you are, just because these platforms can like collect and collate the data that exists and give you that kind of average. Mm-hmm. Like those, I think that's a kind of a new innovation and a new thing we're dealing with in culture is this kind of big datafication of aesthetics and style.
Yeah. So speaking of the big datafication of style, I mean, you make a point in your piece, and I'd love to hear what you have to say about this, and Simon, you too, about when there's any major technological change in human history, there is this question of, like, how will we differentiate or what is style? And you talk about how when photography came along, right, all of a sudden it's like, well, the ability to create some kind of visual image was put in the hands of a lot more people. So painters were panicking. Who will be the next, you know, the next Picasso? Well, it turns out it was kind of a moot question because photography became its own art form. So, yeah. I mean, so are we just sort of, maybe I'm coming around to Simon's point of view. Am I panicking for nothing?
I mean, I think we always have a way of digesting whatever technology that we come up with, right? Humanity has never come up with something that shakes up the culture so much that we can't just adapt over time. And, you know, photography certainly didn't kill painting, but it did shift the role that painting plays in society from kind of documentation and historicizing moments to something that became much more avant-garde and interesting. Like, you know, abstract expressionism followed the rise of photography. So I do wonder, maybe the question is kind of what comes after this. If everyone can be semi-tasteful through these machines, how do we then come up with something new and different and challenging we've digested it?
You know, thinking about it more, with photography, there's still a human behind the camera. There's a human eye seeing these images, bringing us these images. Whereas with algorithmic decision-making, there's the machine. Granted, there's humans designing the code, but the machine doesn't care. The machine, you know, it has glass, but doesn't have a human eye. So, I mean, Simon, doesn't that make a difference that, like, the machine does not care? It's still working on a bunch of rules that is just fed into it.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, I think probably what's going to happen is this period of algorithm-driven clothing for the masses, quote unquote, it won't last forever because look back at the 1970s. That was a period of remarkable flamboyance for everybody. If you look at reruns of Match Game, what everyone's wearing is outrageous. Yeah. And Soul Train and the 70s, Studio 54. So at some point, people are gonna, they'll be a natural evolution out of it. They'll say, "Oh, I had enough basics, I had enough essentials, I had enough unimpeachable clothes." Because I think I'm always looking at it from the point of view of the individual. What's gonna make you feel okay? Forget about what other people think. Forget about making some fatal error, which isn't a fatal error. Mm-hmm. How are you feeling about yourself? Are you feeling groovy? Are you feeling good? And I think there'll be a natural evolution where people are like, I have a closet full of beige, grayish, and donkey-colored clothing, which is all unimpeachably stylish and whatever. No one tells me I look terrible, but I just want to wear a crazy caftan, a vintage find, or something like that. Well, going to make me feel flamboyant and fun.
Yeah. So I have got a couple more questions about sort of not just the philosophical notions of style and taste, but Kyle, I also think we ought to talk about the business of this, right? Because how do we know whether or not, you know, Amazon, Stitch Fix, whatever, not just in terms of clothing fashion, but any algorithm that's designed to help us make these kinds of decisions. How do we know that they're not part of their decision making isn't based on like what they have in the warehouse or what their vendors are supplying and things like that?
Yeah, I think there's this image that algorithmic platforms have that they're giving you exactly what you want. Like they're optimizing for your own desires and shaping themselves around what you consume. But really it's limited to whatever the platform is actually providing you. So with the Amazon Echo look, I took photos of myself in this plaid shirt that I have. And then immediately this little window pops up that's like, hey, do you want to buy these other plaid shirts from Amazon? And so clearly the incentive, one incentive of the system is not just to show me what my style is or to help me judge my fashion choices, but to actually encourage me to buy more clothing from Amazon and help them kind of optimize their products in order for them to sell them to me.
You know, I suppose I'm coming down to the place where, you know, Simon, as you're saying, the algorithms are going to help people who want it, but there will always be room for those who resist, right? Like the folks who, Kyle, you were talking about how maybe they'll just raid their grandma's closet and really rock an amazing scarf they have. Or they'll look for smaller niche products, which are, they're popping up even as we have these sort of mass platforms like Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's like a range of platforms that you can pick from, I think. So maybe this kind of platformization effect might continue going, but then your human choice becomes, well, which system do I participate in?
Yeah.
My experience in the fashion world is that people don't change fundamentally. Like you, Meghna, you described your outfit, jeans, sneakers, but you're...
I'm trying.
I think that's not fine. I'm not a critical person. I don't go around criticizing other people. And I like you. You look like you. That's the main thing. Do you feel like you? Do you look like you? And I think you're never going to show up at work in a silver sequined cat suit. As much as I wish you would.
Literally, everyone in this building now is like, "Do it, Meghna. Do it."
It would be very unusual. Very occasionally, you see somebody who was super preppy, and all of a sudden, they're dyeing their hair, they're wearing outrageous clothes, they're splurging money on designer craziness. That's very unusual. People tend to be cooked at an early age in how they approach their personal style. That's my experience.
Well, I suppose the lesson for us all is use the algorithms if you want, but just be you, right? The clothes may or may not make the man or the woman, but the man or the woman are there. Simon Doonan, fashion writer and creative ambassador at large at Barneys. Thank you so much, Simon.
Thank you. This was fun.
And promise me you'll stand in front of an Amazon look and let us know what happens, how it rates you. And Kyle Chayka, his story, Style is an Algorithm, appeared on the website Racked. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Kyle, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Meghna.
When we come back, we'll talk about Emmanuel Macron's visit to France, to U.S. This is On Point.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Donald Trump hosted his first official state visit of a foreign leader this week. He hosted the man that some call the Trump Whisperer, French President Emmanuel Macron. The two men have formed a fascinating political friendship, but they don't see eye to eye on critical global issues such as the Iran nuclear deal, the war in Syria, and climate change. So what does Macron hope to get out of this visit, and what can Trump gain? Here's Emmanuel Macron addressing a joint meeting of Congress today.
Europe and the United States must face together the global challenges of this century. And we cannot take for granted our transatlantic history and bonds. At the core, our Western values themselves are at risk.
That's French President Emmanuel Macron addressing a joint meeting of Congress today. And you can join the conversation. If France's president has Donald Trump's ear, what do you want Macron to tell him? And what would you like to see coming out of this first ever official state visit hosted by President Donald Trump? Joining us now is Susan Glasser. She's staff writer at The New Yorker and former foreign policy editor at Politico. She's with us from Washington. Susan, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm seeing here that Emmanuel Macron, we heard in that tape before Congress today that, you know, while he's talking about not taking our transatlantic history for granted, he also had some pretty choice words for the United States and nationalism.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, he's just wrapping up the speech right now, and it was an extraordinarily unusual address to a joint meeting of Congress, both the House and the Senate there together. After 2 days of holding hands with President Trump and kissing each other on the cheeks, he came out and he gave basically a full-throated rebuke to Trumpism just down Pennsylvania Avenue, not only referring to nationalism, making a huge case for the United States returning to the Paris Climate Accord that President Trump withdrew from, rebuking him about trade wars, saying that France will not withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, making the case to Trump why he should not either. And, you know, you just have a sort of remarkable spectrum, right, of a French president, a young, energetic 40-year-old French president addressing Congress in English and basically making the case for the multilateral system and the world order that America has built but no longer seems to want to lead.
Okay, so Susan, then, I mean, help us understand what is Emmanuel Macron's goal then for this official state visit? Because so he has these strong words for President Donald Trump before a joint meeting of Congress, but they seem to have a fairly friendly political relationship. And at the beginning of his visit, he makes the tactical decision to do an interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News, speaking to Fox News viewers rather than saying choosing CNN. So what is Macron really trying to accomplish here?
Well, you know, I think it's an excellent question. There's a couple things to remember when thinking about that. Number one, Donald Trump is extremely unpopular in France, as he is throughout Western Europe. I mean, we're talking like 90% unpopularity. And so it's an extremely politically risky move for President Macron, which explains some of the tough messaging and implicit rebuke of Trump in the speech today. At the same time, the United States, of course, is the most important relationship for France, and you know it's not something you can just ignore. And I think that you know there is a benefit, an opportunity, if you will, that Macron saw. President Trump does not have a very strong relationship with the two women who lead America's other two closest allies, Theresa May in the United Kingdom and Angela Merkel, who will be here on Friday for a much less fanfare-filled visit to Washington, right? So Macron had this opportunity to sort of be the designated European interlocutor with President Trump. He seized upon it. And I think, you know, the French have always had this sort of tradition of realism in foreign policy, and I think they're making the calculated political bet that the French public will understand that this is something that Macron needs to do, even if we don't always agree with each other at the moment on policy. However, I did speak with French diplomats before the visit, and basically they said, we are terrified of this. It's a very, very risky threading the needle.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so let's talk about then one of the points at which that Macron and Trump do not see eye to eye, and that's vitally important both for the United States and for Europe. So I want to play some tape here. I'm talking specifically about the Iran nuclear deal. And here is Macron during a press conference yesterday saying that France wants to work on a deal with Iran. And he outlined four topics that need to be addressed regarding the Iran nuclear deal.
The first one is to block any nuclear activity of Iran till 2025. This was feasible thanks to the JCPOA. The second is to make sure that in the long run there is no nuclear Iranian activity. The third fundamental topic is to be able to put an end to the ballistic activities of Iran in the region. And the fourth one is to generate the conditions for a political solution to contain Iran in the region, in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, and in Lebanon.
So that's obviously a translator translating the words of French President Emmanuel Macron on Iran and its nuclear program. On the other hand, President Donald Trump warned Iran about implementing the use of their nuclear program. Again, this is in the same press conference with Macron yesterday.
They restart their nuclear program, they will have bigger problems than they have ever had before.
Susan Glasser, I don't see any headway being made here between the Trump whisperer and the president himself.
Well, you know, it was always going to be an uphill lobbying thing. I mean, Donald Trump has a very interesting pattern of, you know, wanting to be liked by these fellow world leaders, saying what he feels will please them when he's meeting with them or on the phone with them. But, you know, he reverts to certain real views that he has expressed for a long time, often on policy issues, whether it's trade, for example. Remember, he gave the speech to the economic leaders in Davos, right, and he sounded like one of them, but came back and imposed his trade tariffs nonetheless. And I think on the Iran deal, he's been very consistent since the campaign.
Yeah.
Worst deal ever, doesn't like it, finding a way around it. He's had a series of sort of kick the can down the road, right? Decisions first to decertify the Iranian compliance with the Iran deal, even though international inspectors say they have in fact complied with the terms of it, but not yet to officially do anything. So he faces this new deadline in May 12th. That's why Macron is here. It's why Merkel is here. Their number one priority is lobbying him on the Iran deal. I don't believe fundamentally Trump is ever going to at least publicly admit that he has changed his mind about the nuclear deal. So the question is, can the Europeans come up with something where they argue that they are addressing, or at least might have the prospect of addressing, some of the things that are not in the nuclear deal?
Yeah. So can I just jump in here, Susan? Because this gets a little confusing at times, right? Because it seems as if Macron was proposing the possibility of a new agreement, a new Iran agreement that would address the Trump administration's concerns. But on the other hand, you know, Tehran is saying that the deal, this current deal, isn't up for negotiation. And I'm seeing here that the European Union's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, is saying today that Europe is going to stick to the existing Iran deal, distancing herself from the French proposal. So exactly what's going on here? Is Macron deliberately going out on a limb?
Well, look, no, he's trying to thread the needle. And by the way, just to be clear, Macron, in his speech to Congress just now, said the same thing that Federica Mogherini said. They're all saying it, which is, we're not going to pull out of the existing nuclear deal. What Macron is saying is, we're going to try to enlarge it. We're going to try to add on to it with a new set of agreements or conditions that we're imposing on Iran that deal with things that are not in the deal. And so that's his strategy, is to say, don't blow up the deal that exists, but go ahead and layer onto it with other agreements. Now, A, as you pointed out, it's very unlikely that Iran is going to agree to any of these additional terms that Europe and the United States might put before them, right? And so that's number one. Obviously, the Obama administration, if they could have gotten an agreement on a forever ban on Iranian testing of nuclear things, they would have done so. They weren't able to do that. That's why the deal sunset. Same thing on ballistic missiles. They weren't able to get that in the original deal. But that's Macron's strategy. He's not saying, well, we're going to go along with Trump and France is going to pull out of the Iran deal. He's saying, no way, we're sticking with what's existing, but we're going to try to keep negotiating nonetheless.
Yeah. Let's take a quick call here. Brooke is calling from Tahlequah, Oklahoma. You're on the air, Brooke.
Hi, Meghna. I was just wanting to make a comment on Macron's choice to do the interview with Fox News. I think that most of us who recognize the issues with Donald Trump and the French people recognize that if he does want to speak to Trump and speak to Trump supporters, that's really the forum that he has to do it in if he wants to be effective.
Right. Speaking directly to some his most ardent supporters who frequently watch Fox News. Brooke, thank you so much for your call. Susan, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I think she makes an excellent point. You know, one thing about President Trump is that, you know, he is in some weird way, very, very transparent, right? We have this access to this Twitter feed of his. We have more, in a way, unfiltered access to what the President of the United States is watching on TV and thinking and being exposed to than really ever before. And it's pretty darn clear that, you know, being on Fox News is one of the fastest ways to speak directly to President Trump and those around him. And if you're lobbying President Trump, as President Macron is, that was probably smart media strategy on his part. But again, it points out the risks, right?
Yeah.
You're only speaking to part of a very divided America. And it's particularly ironic because on policy issues, of course, Macron and really the mainstream of French politics is much more aligned with the Democratic Party in the United States today than with the Republican Party.
Susan, I want to talk to you for a minute about the actual relationship between these two world leaders. And let me just play a couple pieces of tape here. This is from yesterday. First of all, during a state luncheon in Washington, where President Macron praised the cooperation between the U.S., France, and other Western nations for the past 70 years.
An economic, financial, political order has been put together after the Second World War. Is it perfect? Probably not. Can it be improved? Definitely. Have we seen anything better? I do not think so.
Again, that's Emmanuel Macron through an interpreter. President Trump did express his affection for President Macron. This was also at the White House yesterday.
We do have a very special relationship. In fact, I'll get that little piece of dandruff for a little piece. We have to make him perfect. He is perfect. So it is really great to be with you, and you are a special friend. Thank you.
And that's the president, President Trump, picking what he said was a piece of dandruff off President Macron's suit there. Susan, I mean, you know, I started this conversation with you referencing the fact that some folks call President Macron the Trump whisperer. I mean, is that is that an accurate description of the kind of relationship they have?
You know, he has seemed to read President Trump and to see how you can get some of what you want more clearly and more artfully than many of his other world leader compatriots, especially in Europe. You know, some of the Europeans really have not hit it off with President Trump. Angela Merkel, for example, he doesn't like being lectured to. This man loves a good military parade. He loves a red carpet. That's exactly what Macron rolled out for him last summer in France for the Bastille Day. And, you know, I think, again, you know, French officials are very well aware that this is a risky political move for someone like President Macron. You know, President Trump has a long history of saying what people want but not necessarily delivering. And Macron has to go back with something concrete. I'm still not sure what that is. It's not getting a lot of attention, but I was told even before the visit that they had agreed not to put out the traditional joint statement that would occur in such a formal state visit because there are so many substantive disagreements on policy issues. So I think it's a very legitimate question for French people to ask, which is what exactly their president has gotten out of coming here to the United States and holding hands with Donald Trump.
So then the flip side to that, let's ask, what does President Trump stand to gain from this visit? What do you think?
Well, that is also a good thing. Well, number one, I think, again, he loves being flattered, and he loves the appearance that he is the preeminent leader on the world stage and that he matters and that even, you know, a young, vibrant, handsome young leader of France who disagrees with him on policy is coming to pay homage to him. And so this definitely plays into Trump's grand narrative of himself as a world leader. And that's something that certainly pleases his vanity and is probably good for him politically. I have to say, up until today, we'll see how people cover the speech to Congress. But this has been some of the best publicity, frankly, of Donald Trump's presidency that he's gotten for this state visit.
Yeah. And so, but I'm also wondering, I mean, we've seen time and again that in President Trump, here's a man who really does value deeply his personal relationships, possibly to a fault, right? But if the exercise, the diplomatic exercise of this state visit does strengthen his personal relationship to Emmanuel Macron, I mean, I keep thinking about you saying that, like, Macron's trying to thread the needle here. What if he does that successfully? I mean, could that bear fruit down the road? Could Macron be the fulcrum around which Europe does get the United States, perhaps, to adjust its very hardline stance on some of these key issues?
Well, you know, I wouldn't put all your eggs in that basket.
Your sigh says everything.
I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking, how should I respond? And I, you know, I think you have to be very realistic about President Trump. This, so far, I think, has been playing out very much as I expected it to. It's fascinating to watch the personal chemistry between them. And I do believe that already President Trump has shown, you know, he called NATO obsolete on the campaign trail, but he has not blown up NATO, quite the contrary. You know, you could argue that he's been useful. Yeah. To NATO in getting more defense budgets higher across Europe.
I guess the answer is we'll have to see, right? Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker and former foreign policy editor at Politico, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is On Point.